Yeah, thank you. This is absolutely lovely. This is joint work with Tony Licata from the Australian National University, and at this point also a fair amount of input by my undergrad student Leo Young. It's a J. Lucy asked me the same thing. Before I start, when I talked to people at lunch, it seemed like everybody was okay with the idea of a growth ending group. Originally, I planned to briefly explain what that is, but if everybody knows, then I won't. So maybe hands up if you know what a growth ending group is. Okay. All right. So let me tell you just really briefly what the plan is. I've given related talks before, and for the first time, I decided to focus more on the general framework in this talk rather than one specific example. I'll tell you a lot of general nonsense, but I'll keep some running examples throughout so that it stays a bit grounded. First of all, let me just make sure we all understand what I mean by a lattice. So I just mean a finitely generated free abelian group with a non-degenerate symmetric bilinear form. So that's what a lattice is. And this is a very basic mathematical object, but it has a lot of connections to all kinds of other areas of mathematics. So I'll just mention a few, to Lie theory, like root lattices, to graph theory, since I apparently promised combinatorics. If you take a graph G, then connected graph, then there's two famous lattices associated to this, and these are called the lattice of integer cuts and the lattice of integer flows. I won't explain exactly what these are, but if at some point you took a course in combinatorics, you would have heard of the min cut max flow theorem. This is the same cuts and flows. And then some things that I know much less about: exceptional simple groups, error correcting codes, and so on and so forth. So it's very connected to other mathematics, probably because it's such a basic object. There's one particular aspect of lattice theory that I'm interested in, and that is the fact that lattices appear very naturally as growth-ending groups of categories. And I'll explain this a little bit via a couple of examples. The first one, the example of zigzag algebras. By Kovanov and Horfano, this is zigzag algebras provide a categorification of root lattices, and it works the following way. You take an ADE root lattice to this, there's an associated Dynkin diagram, which is some graph that looks something like this. And then associated to this Dynkin diagram, they do some sort of path algebra construction. So they take all the paths on this graph, with the operation being multiplication, and they mod out by some relations. I will not describe the details of this, just say some path algebra construction. And what they get, let's call this root lattice L. So we get an algebra AL, and this is called the zigzag algebra. And it's called the zigzag algebra because of the relations that they mod out by look like, inspired that name. And this algebra, because it's a path algebra, it's naturally graded by path length. Because the relations are homogeneous, so they don't mess that up. And then you take the category PL, which is the category of finitely generated graded projective AL modules. And the statement is that K0 of PL is the lattice L. But what's the meaningful part of this statement? So of course, as in like K0 of PL is just a free abelian group of the correct rank, where the rank is the number of nodes in the Dynkin diagram. But that's not the meat in the soup. Sorry, that's a Hungarian phrase, and it's not very vegetarian friendly. So K0 is just the span of isomorphism classes. This is the definition of the Grothendieck group, modded out by the relation that sum is direct sum. And this happens to be a free abelian group by the Jordan-Holder theorem, and it happens to have the right rank. But the important part is that if you define an inner product on this space by just taking dimensions of Hom sets, now this is these are all graded things. So let's say graded dimension or Poincaré polynomial. So these values are polynomials where the Q keeps track of the degrees of the homomorphisms. But then you can get a number by setting Q to a certain value, and this certain value is -1. Then the indecomposable projectives correspond with the vertices of the Dynkin diagram with the right inner product. In other words, as you, or at least most of you probably know, the root lattice has a basis corresponding to the vertices of the Dynkin diagram, and you have a, you know, you have the pairings described by what's connected to what. And when you take the inner products between that basis, those correspond to the basis of this Grothendieck group given by the indecomposable projectives, and you get the right inner products. All right, so that's example number one. And example number two is a categorified integer cuts and flows. And this is due to myself and Tony Licata. All right, so a similar story, but different in some subtle ways. Take a connected graph. And as I said before, even though I said very little about them, to this graph there are two lattices associated. One is called the lattice of integer cuts, and the other is called the lattice of integer flows. Let me give them some names. So this is cuts, and this is flows. And one property that I'd like you to know is that both of these sit inside the free abelian group spanned by the edges of G, and they are mutual orthogonal complements. And when I say mutual orthogonal complements, if I was talking about a vector space, then that would be superfluous to say, but we are over Z. So if I take an orthogonal complement and then I take the orthogonal complement of that, I don't necessarily get the original thing back. So the mutual here has some meaning. Okay, and one more piece of information. If I pick a spanning tree, of the graph. So what is that? If you take a connected graph, a spanning tree is just a tree which contains all of the vertices. A tree is a circle-free subgraph. So a spanning tree of this would, for example, be that. So if you pick a spanning tree, then you get bases, some special bases corresponding to the spanning tree for both of these lattices. Okay, and then the categorification works the following way. Take the graph and the spanning tree. From this, in some very combinatorial manner, construct a bipartite graph. Let's denote that by BGT. And then do some path algebra construction. And get an algebra AGT. And this is a naturally graded just like before. From this algebra, we get a category. Maybe C is a bad letter, right? Because we had Z for cuts. I didn't think that through. Let's call it D. Which is the category of finitely generated graded A, G, T modules. And the Grothendieck group, so this categorifies the lattice of integer flows and the lattice of integer cuts in the following sense. You have k0 of dgt is z to the edges. So this is just basically a Euclidean lattice. So if you take the basis of the standard modules or the co-standard modules, then you get a Euclidean lattice. But inside, you have cuts and flows. And the cuts correspond to some simple modules. And the flows correspond to the opposite or the complementary. Projectives with an actual lattice isomorphism. So these are just free abelian groups. So that part is pretty obvious. But they are lattices with a given inner product. And for that inner product, here you need to take, because it's not just projective modules. HOM doesn't work well, so you have to take ext, but it's the same idea. Okay. So, a little bit different setting, but similar procedure. Okay, so that is what I wanted to say about categorification. And then how do we get quantized lattices from this? Well, when we take the growth ND groups in order to get the original lattices back, what we were doing was taking some graded dimension and then setting the resulting variable equal to -1, or taking some graded dimension and setting the resulting variable equal to 1. So if we quantized lattices is the step in between, where you take the growth ND group, but you keep track of the grading. So just not getting rid of the Q. Okay, so then what is that? What do you get if you keep the Q? You get a free ZQQ inverse module. So a free module over the Laurent polynomials in Q, integer coefficients, with a non-degenerate Q semilinear form. And I'll explain what that is and why. Let's unpack this definition. So first of all, Here's a disturbing detail. ZQQ inverse is not a PID. And so even though in the original definition, a lattice was a free module by definition, in the original context, because Z is a PID, free or torsion-free is the same thing. But here, we have a non-PID, so it's not immediately obvious why it's free that we should assume as opposed to torsion-free. But I say that the right definition is to assume that it's free. And that's because in this growth and degroup context, in practice, the things you get are free. Because when you take the growth and degroup of some category of modules, then you'll have a Jordan Holder theorem. Which says that that thing is a free module. And if you take growth and degroup over, as long as your algebra is not obscene, and if you take projective modules, then you have some Kroll-Schmidt property. That will say that it's free. So in this growth and degroup context, in practice, you'll be working with free modules. And so I say free is the right thing to assume there. And then what about the semilinear business? So what does Q semilinear mean? It means that when you have an inner product and you want to bring a Q out, then from one side of the inner product, it will come out proper. The other side, it will come out as a Q inverse. So why is that? It's because a Q means a grading shift. And when you have a HOM, in one side, the grading shift will affect the HOM just straight, like 1-to-1. And the other side, it will be 1-to--1. So, so if you take HOM A to B shifted by 1. This is HOM of A to B shifted by 1. But if you take HOM of A shifted by 1 to B, this is HOM A to B shifted by minus 1. So the result of this in terms of the form is that QXY is Q inverse XY, but XQY is Q times XY. Now, this sounds reasonable. But it has some disturbing consequences, because once your form is not symmetric, you have to say left orthogonal and right orthogonal and all those things. So it's a minefield of bad intuition, that coupled with the non-PID. A quick note, people do study lattices over not Z. Usually people stick to PIDs, and that's because non-PIDs just become a mess with all the things that go wrong. But actually, ZQQ inverse, for being a non-PID, it's not so bad. And one of the reasons that it's not so bad is a theorem of Swan's from, I think, 78, which says that over ZQQ inverse, any projective module is free. And so when you get into trouble here, right, I take a Q lattice and I assume that it's free. And then in proofs and computations and whatnot, you'll want to do things like, OK, let's take the sublattice generated by this and this and this and this. And then you would get into trouble that not necessarily being free. So every time you take a submodule, you would have to prove that it's a sublattice. But it's actually not that doesn't go wrong, because when you have a free thing, you take a sub that's projective, and that will imply that it's free. So that's sort of a saving grace that makes things.
Why is a sub of a free thing projective in this context?
I guess. Okay, you have to know that it's a summand. That's true.
Yes.
Yeah.
I agree if it's a summand.
Yeah, it's a summand. Yeah. Yeah, so that is a helpful fact. And then what's the general goal of this whole project? Basically, in broad terms, we want to develop the Q analog of classical lattice theory. And ideally, also the category analog. And see if that says new things about either lattices or those particular lattices, whether the theorems that exist in lattice theory also appear in this homological algebra level, and whether those homological algebra lifts of lattice theory theorems are something interesting on their own right. So there's a few branches in which we've been trying to go. One is these cut and flow lattices. Where we have a specific construction and we can prove things about that specific construction, and that gives quantized analogs of these graph invariants, and we can prove things about what those what the combinatorial meaning, the graph theory meaning of those are. Second is just general understanding of how quantized lattices work. And then we have a plan for what the next reasonable concrete example is. And I'll tell you a little bit about that. Those are Niemeyer lattices. But we don't really understand that yet. So for the rest of this talk, I'll just give you a sampling of results that we have and results that we don't have. And hopefully That will give you a general idea of what this all looks like. No, usually, well, in the examples that I know, you first categorify it, and then that gives you a quantization. Now, from those examples, like, I can give you an algorithm. Give me a pairing matrix for a lattice, and I'll give you back a quantized version. But I think that's not on its own without a categorification behind it. That's a little ad hoc. But at the same time, these quantized lattices that you get from categorifications follow some general theory of quant, like they fit into this general framework of quantized lattices the same way that lattices themselves fit into the general framework of lattices. And so we've been trying to sort of lay the groundwork of what is the theory of quantized lattices in general with these examples in mind. And of course, trying to come up with more good classes of examples that are instructive would be good to test whether all these definitions are the right definitions. Okay, so I'll do this as a two-column thing. So on the left, I'll tell you classical facts, and on the right, I'll tell you Q facts. So fact number one, going back to cuts and flows, there's a theorem, 2010 by Caparaso, Viviani, and Sue Wagner, which says that each of these things, and I'll just state it for flows, but it also applies to cuts the same way. You can just swap the flows to cuts, that these are very strong graph invariants in the following sense. So if you have an isomorphism between the lattices of integer flows of two graphs, then you know that there exists a one-to-one correspondence, a bijection between the edges of these graphs, which preserves cycles. And I don't know if many of you are familiar with matroids, but this is essentially saying that G is isomorphic to G prime as matroids. That's a sloppy way to say it, but there's a combinatorial structure, combinatorial gadget called matroids. All graphs can be seen as matroids. And when you see a theorem like this in graph theory, generally, it can be stated much more generally as a theorem about so-called regular matroids, which as a special case includes this. And the big perk that you get from that is that graphs have a really nice duality, but it only applies to planar graphs, right? Planar graphs you might have, you know, learned in kindergarten or something in some math camp. You can take a planar graph and then put a dot in each of the regions and connect with an edge along each of the edges, and then you get another planar graph, which is the dual of that planar graph. And this notion doesn't apply to graphs in general, but if you go up to matroids, then all of a sudden all graphs have a dual as a matroid, and that dual remains a graph if and only if the original graph is a planar graph. So you have this really nice duality notion, and that's really relevant to everything I was saying before, because in our categorification, that duality corresponds with Kosul duality of the algebras. So that's just a little aside.
Are there cut and flow lattices for general matroids?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Regular matroids, which means regular matroids is just, so matroids are a very general thing. It's just some set with a notion of independence that follows some axioms. And they come, the main examples come from graph theory where independence is being a tree, or from vector spaces where independent is being independent. There are matroids that don't come from vector spaces at all, and those are bad. And then there's matroids that come from vector spaces, but only over some specific field, like only over Z2 or only over Q or something. And the regular matroid is something that comes from a vector space over any field. And in particular, all matroids that come from graphs are regular matrices. So that's sort of the right generalization whenever you want to phrase a graph theorem in terms of matroids so that you can talk about Kosul duality or whatever, then you need to talk about regular matrices. Okay. So that's the classical story. And then we have a corresponding story. We have a graph and a spanning tree. Then to that, we can associate these Q lattices. But that takes the data of the spanning tree in the construction. And the theorem is that an isomorphism of these Q lattices implies that there exists a bijection between the edge sets, which takes one spanning tree to the other, and of course preserves cycles. So it has some sort of spanning tree remembering property. What did I want to say? These are actually if and only if. It's just that the other direction's easy. So that direction is the real theorem. That direction is a proposition.
How many examples of such bijections are there that aren't graph isomorphisms?
They don't have to be graph isomorphisms. Oh. So the it doesn't really limit it being a non-isomorphism. These edge bijections are called two isomorphisms, and there's a theorem that all two isomorphisms can be constructed as a sequence of a specific these are called Whitney flips. So you take a graph, you take like two vertices of the graph, so that if you remove those two vertices, then the graph falls apart. So you have like the left side and the right side, and in between you have the two vertices, and the Whitney flip is doing this. So you can do a sequence of this, and that's a two isomorphism. And that's bijection of edges. You can check, it's obvious, it preserves cycles. And I mean, take a graph with a spanning tree, do a Whitney flip, you get a different graph with a different spanning tree. But it follows, in particular, that if you have a graph with the property that if you remove any two vertices, it's still connected, these graphs are called three connected, then for a three connected graph, any such bijection is actually a graph isomorphism. Erase this too so that I have two columns. So next, let's go to some completely general stuff. What if you wanted to classify lattices or certain kinds of lattices, at least of small ranks? Then you would want to have some way of taking small lattices and building bigger lattices out of them. So how would one do that? Well, of course, I could take a direct sum. So take two small lattices, take their direct sum so that they are just orthogonal to each other. But that's not very interesting. But there's a way to make that a little bit more interesting, namely, take two small lattices, take their direct sum so that they are orthogonal, and then from like, you just tensor up with Q or make it a vector space. And then try to add in some extra vectors which don't lie in either one of them so that it remains, so that the inner product remains integer valued. And this is called gluing. So basically, you take a direct sum and then you densify it a little bit so that it's no longer a direct sum, no longer, can no longer be expressed as a direct sum of lower rank lattices. So how does one densify a lattice? How do you know if it can be densified? Well, any vector that you add, if you're not going to increase the rank, then it would come out of the tensor with the quotient field, and you get a vector space. And then in that vector space, you'd have to find vectors which pair integrally with any vector in L. Because otherwise, if you try to densify, you're not going to get an integer valued inner product. So that's called the dual lattice. And the dual lattice, I mean, it's still a free abelian group, but it's not going to be a lattice in the sense that I defined in the beginning, because those different axes might not pair integrally with each other or even with themselves. So the densifying is a non-trivial operation, right? It might be impossible. But this suggests a notion of a special kind of lattice, which basically has maximum density, right? If this L dual is the same as L, that's called a unimodular lattice. And there's a classification of unimodular lattices of small ranks, due to Conway and Sloan. That's a really pretty piece of mathematics that I'll try to say a few words about a little bit later. But first, let me tell you one special thing. If you wanted to classify unimodular lattices, what you would do is you would take small lattices, you would take direct sum them together, and then you would try to densify them so much that you get a unimodular lattice. And often, that's going to be impossible, because you start densifying, and then you find that you can't add the next vector, because the integerness breaks down somewhere in all cases. So so here's an interesting theorem. Suppose that you were able to glue together a unimodular lattice from two lattices L1 and L2. What would that mean? It would mean that L1 and L2 sit as mutual orthogonal complements in L at the end of the procedure. So if L1 and L2 are mutual orthogonal complements in a unimodular L, then the glue groups, which are just the dual lattice mod out by the original lattice, which would be, it's a torsion group, right? Because they are of the same rank. So mod out the dual lattice by the lattice, you get a finite abelian group, and these are isomorphic. So not any two lattices do you have any chance of gluing together to get a unimodular lattice. But it's not an if and only if theorem. So you could take L1 and L2, which satisfy this criterion, and still be unable to glue them to get something unimodular.
So that glue group has a pairing into Q mod Z. So if they're isomorphic with the pairing into Q mod Z, then can you?
If they are isomorphic with the pairing. That's an excellent question.
I mean, basically the graph of the isomorphism.
Yeah.
With the minus sign should give you the unimodular thing.
Yeah, that might be true. Yeah, that's a great point. All right, so moving on to Q side. Luckily, that fit in one column. So first of all, we would have to define the Q analog of this business, of the dual. And that would have to be a different notion for left dual and right dual, depending on whether XV is always in ZQQ inverse or VX is always in ZQQ inverse. Okay. There's a little bit to worry about there. You would want to know, you would want to be sure that those are actually free modules, but they are, because the dual thing has a dual basis, and the independence of the dual basis is still it still holds. So you have, if LQ is a Q lattice, you have this LQ left dual, LQ right dual. I won't bore you writing down the same definition again, just with swapping the inner products. So these live in LQ tensor. The quotient field, and in this case, the quotient field is rational functions, and they are free ZQQ inverse modules. But now the pairing is not no longer ZQQ inverse valued. And I claim that saying that LQ is the same equals its right dual is equivalent to saying that LQ equals its left dual. So definition, then we call LQ unimodular. And then gluing Q lattices would be a similar procedure where you take a direct sum and then throw in some extra vectors from the intersection of the left dual and the right dual. And there's a theorem along the lines of that one. If two lattices L1 and L2, this is ours. If two lattices L1 and two Q lattices L1 and L2 sit in a Q lattice L, I'll drop the Qs because writing LQ1, LQ2 gets a little cumbersome. With the property that L1, the right orthogonal complement of L1 is L2, and L1 is the left orthogonal complement of L2. So this is the analog of saying they are mutual orthogonal complements. And we have to assume a little bit extra. This is the non-PID awkwardness. We have to assume that L mod L1 and L mod L2 are free. So L mod L1 and L mod L2 are automatically torsion free, but not automatically free. That now has to be said. Then the right dual of L1 mod L1 is isomorphic to the left dual of L2 mod L2. And there's a corollary of this for the cut and flow lattices, because those sit inside the free abelian group generated by the edges, but more generally a free ZQQ inverse module whose rank is the number of edges. And so this implies that Q flow right dual mod Q flow is isomorphic to Q cut left dual mod Q cut. And in the last 5 minutes, let me tell you something we don't understand. There's in this classification of small lattices, there's a beautiful piece of mathematics, which is classifying even unimodular lattices. What does even mean? That's very simple. Lattice is even if the norm or norm squared of every vector in it is even. And there's a theorem which says that if L is even unimodular with positive definite pairing, then the rank is divisible by 8. And there's a full classification of even unimodular lattices in rank 8, 16, 24, and I think almost 32, but not quite. Let me tell you what they are. Rank 8, there's a single one. Can anybody guess what it is? E8. In rank 16, now don't completely take my word for this, because I know this from memory and my reference is in Sydney, and then I tried to double check and I couldn't find it online. So the reference is the Book of Conway Sloan. On sphere packings, lattices, and groups. And there's 3 isomorphism classes. And one of them, of course, is E8 plus E8. And then in rank 24, there's 24 isoclasses of these even unimodular lattices, and they are uniquely determined by their set of root vectors. Where root is just a vector of norm or norm squared 2. And one of these 24, there's no roots. So no length 2 vectors. By the way, length 2 here is the minimal length because we are even. One of the classes is no roots, and this is the famous Leech lattice. And then 23 of the classes are called Niemeyer lattices. And each of these are obtained from gluing ADE root lattices. And here's the miraculous fact. When you glue ADE root lattices, you will only succeed if all of the root lattices that you glue have the same Coxeter number. And of course, the ranks have to add up to 24. And there's 23 different ways of selecting ADE root lattices whose ranks add up to 24 and who all have the same Coxeter numbers. And all of those ways will work out. But that theorem is not a theorem like this, where you say you will only succeed if they have the same Coxeter number. It's like a long classification where you're, I actually, on my to-do list, this is to understand exactly how this classification goes. But it's like case analysis, do this, do that, try this, try that, this will work, that will not work, blah, blah, blah. And at the end, you say, oh, look, it's all the ways in which you can put together root lattices of the same Coxeter number. So completely mysterious. And now this would be a natural next step to categorify or qify, because we have categorifications of the root lattices via the zigzag algebras. We sort of understand how gluing works a little bit. So why not just do this on the category level or at least on the Q level? But there's some bizarre stuff happening. So starting with the most basic example of E8, when you take the QE8 coming from the zigzag algebra, this thing is not Q unimodular in this sense, because what's an equivalent notion of this? If these are equalities, then if you write the matrix of this inclusion, that matrix would be invertible over ZQQ inverse. So that means it would have a determinant plus or minus power of Q, which are the units of ZQQ inverse. And that matrix happens to be the same as the pairing matrix in some basis. And so basically, an equivalent condition for being unimodular. That the pairing matrix has determinant plus or minus q to the k for some integer k. But the determinant of QE8, of the pairing matrix of QE8, is instead the 20th cyclotomic polynomial. So certainly, if you plug in q equals 1 or minus 1, then you get 1. But otherwise, not. So we don't know. So that means that there's some notion that we are missing here, some relaxation of this notion of strictly unimodular. Maybe it would be Q weakly unimodular or something. And we played around a fair amount with these Q root lattices and trying to glue them, trying to find glue vectors. There's an awful lot of cyclotomic polynomials. Don't really know why, but I think that's very intriguing. I'll end it.
So, do you know whether there are any like rank 8 Q unimodular correct generalization of even is?
No.
Okay.
No, I don't. Yeah, and that's that's something that we should do and haven't done is instead of sort of trying to copy the construction, try to do the classification instead, sort of going top down, that we haven't done.
Somehow this quotient, this is something about like this stable.
Yeah.
Should be finite global dimension. Maybe not, maybe accepting that is something you should get.
Yeah, totally. I agree.
So, I mean, do you have some statement about stable categories?
Not worked out. So on the level that you've just said, we have looked at this and said, yeah, some sort of stable category, but not, we haven't worked it out.
Like duality in the picture.
Yeah. Yeah, because there's definitely stuff to do in that direction.
Any other question?
What are these formulas for, like, how many counting integer lattices? What do they call them? Minkowski something? You know the stuff I'm talking about?
Not really. So I know that it has to do with this sort of combinatorial geometry, but not really familiar with that part.
Jacob Lurie's been doing some stuff about this, like this Tanaka-Wunderman conjecture for characteristic P. But there's like really beautiful formulas for like how many lattices of such and such a rank. You know, what are lattices? I was just wondering if they would also, if these formulas would also hold for Q lattices.
Mm. Yeah, I should look into that.
Because that's, you know, you don't need to do this for this 24 lattices. You just look at the formula and see all those 24 of them.
Yeah.